Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. U.S. President Barack Obama arrived in Kenya Friday evening amid extremely tight security for the start of a landmark two-day visit. Security forces have been patrolling the capital, which has been put on a virtual lockdown for Obama's first visit to the country as president. The big headline for the visit is a global entrepreneurship summit, the first it has been, that is being held in Africa. President Obama, as co-host, will address the gathering on Saturday. While much of the visit will focus on boosting trade, the other big issue on the agenda will be security when Obama meets President Uhuru Kenyatta. Kenya has been targeted repeatedly by the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. The deadliest attack took place at Garissa University College in April when 148 people, most of them students, were killed. After 2 days in Kenya, Obama will become the first U.S. president to visit Ethiopia. Police in the U.S. state of Louisiana have identified the gunman who opened fire Thursday evening in a movie theater, killing two people and wounding nine others before killing himself. Officials in the town of Lafayette say they are seeking more information about the suspect, 59-year-old John Russell Hauser. Lafayette Police Chief Jim Kraft described him as a kind of a drifter. About 100 people were in the theater watching the film Trainwreck when the gunman began shooting with a handgun. It was apparent that he was intent on shooting and escaping, Kraft said. A quick response forced him back into the theater, at which point he killed himself. There is no word on a possible motive at this time. This is VOA News. Earlier this month, the U.S. government revealed that its plan to train and equip thousands of moderate rebels to fight the Islamic State in Syria has not materialized, with only 60 recruits in training. As Turkey joins the fight and the Syrian government advances on ISIS-controlled territories, officials say they hope more localized efforts will yield better results. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Cairo.
For about a year, U.S. President Barack Obama has called for the arming and training of ground troops in Syria and Iraq to fight the self-proclaimed Islamic State, also known as ISIS or ISIL, or the Arabic term Daesh. This is U.S. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter in Iraq on Thursday.
We will defeat Daesh because civilization always wins over barbarity. But to defeat Daesh, we need capable ground forces.
Earlier this month, Carter said the plan to train and arm these moderate rebels is going slowly, with only 60 men in training as opposed to the thousands they had planned to train this year. From across the border, for the first time, Turkish warplanes are attacking Islamic State targets in Syria, and suspected supporters are being arrested in Turkey. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
The U.S. military says an airstrike earlier this month in southeastern Afghanistan killed a top al-Qaeda commander. Pentagon Press Secretary Peter Cook said in a statement Friday, "We have confirmed that Abu Khalil al-Sudani, a high-ranking al-Qaeda operational commander, was killed by a U.S. airstrike in Bermal District, Paktia Province, Afghanistan, on July 11, 2015. The statement described al-Sudani as the head of the Sunni militant group's suicide and explosive operations, adding that he was directly linked to plotting attacks on U.S., Afghan, and Pakistani forces. European regulators have given a green light to a prospective new malaria vaccine, setting it on the path to possible licensing and assessment by the World Health Organization. The European Medicines Agency said Friday that the drug should be licensed for babies and very young children, despite mixed results in efficacy testing. Burundi's President Pierre Nkurunziza has won a third term in office amid continued controversy over whether his re-election is constitutional. Mr. Nkurunziza won 69% of the vote, while his closest rival, Agathon Rwasa, got 19%. And a report in the New York Times newspaper says two federal inspectors general have asked the Justice Department to open a criminal investigation into whether Hillary Clinton mishandled sensitive government information on a private email account she used when she was the U.S. Secretary of State. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
U.S. President Barack Obama arrives in Kenya Friday evening for the start of a landmark two-day visit to discuss trade and security. Kenyans hope to capitalize on Mr. Obama's first visit to the country as president.
That's VOA's East Africa correspondent Gabe Joslow reporting from Nairobi. Details next. Also in the news, Burundi's president Pierre Nkurunziza has won a third term in office. And Nigeria's president Muhammadu Buhari visits Cameroon next week. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Burundi, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Burundi's president, Pierre Nkurunziza, has won a third term in office after continued controversy over whether his re-election is constitutional. Mr. Nkurunziza won 69% of the vote, while his closest rival, Agathon Rwasa, got 19%. Electoral chief Pierre Clavier Ndaikariye said the tally gave him a first-round victory. The U.S. and Britain have condemned Tuesday's vote as not credible due to pre-election violence, alleged intimidation of opposition groups, and questions over whether the president is violating the Constitution's two-term limit. Opponents contend a third term violates the Constitution and the peace deal that ended Burundi's civil war in 2006. But Burundi's constitutional court ruled that Mr. Nkurunziza was eligible to run because he was chosen by lawmakers rather than voters for his first term in 2005. U.S. President Barack Obama arrives in Kenya this evening for the start of a landmark two-day visit to discuss trade and security. Kenyans hope to capitalize on Mr. Obama's first visit to the country as president. VOA East Africa correspondent Gabe Joslow has more from Nairobi.
The streets in Nairobi have been painted and polished as the city has spared no expense to welcome the U.S. president to Kenya. The big headline for the visit is a global entrepreneurship summit, the first time it is being held in Africa. President Obama, as co-host, will address the gathering on Saturday. Kenya also has special significance for the U.S. president. His father was born and is buried in rural western Kenya and served in the government of Kenya's first president. Mr. Obama last visited in 2006 as a U.S. senator, but this is his first trip as president. And that, says Kenyan Deputy President William Ruto, means a lot to his country.
President Obama is not just any other American president. He has African roots, and more specifically Kenyan roots. And so it is significant in a very different way.
While much of the visit will focus on boosting trade, the other big issue on the agenda will be security when Mr. Obama meets President Uhuru Kenyatta Saturday. Kenyan Foreign Secretary Amina Mohamed says it is a common top concern.
Our collaboration, especially on security, is historic. It's been there. Of course, we've enhanced it a lot in the last few years because of the threat, the global threat, actually, that we all face.
Kenya has been targeted repeatedly by the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. The deadliest attack took place at Garissa University College in April, when 148 people, most of them students, were slaughtered on campus. Security has been beefed up and the capital put on a virtual lockdown for Mr. Obama's two-day visit. Nothing, however, will dampen the excitement across the country for what Kenyans have called Mr. Obama's homecoming. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
While President Obama's trip to Africa will focus on the entrepreneurial summit, he's also expected to discuss terrorism with the leaders of Kenya and Ethiopia. Both Kenya and Ethiopia have waged campaigns against the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. Tricia Bacon is an associate professor at American University who focuses on terror threats. She spoke to VOA's Jody Kapawa about how big an issue this will be during President Obama's trip to Kenya and Ethiopia.
Counterterrorism has been a big part of our bilateral relationship with Kenya for decades now. So invariably, this is going to come up over the course of the visit. The other main thing that will determine how much of an issue that it is whether al-Shabaab is able to conduct any kinds of attacks or operation that capture the headlines and bring it back to the forefront, in which case then it will be probably become a larger part of the agenda than was originally intended.
Are you talking about al-Shabaab trying to do something during Mr. Obama's visit?
That is a possibility. The group has suffered some setbacks in recent weeks. It's been pushed out of some of its strongholds in the south. It's been damaged by airstrikes. And when groups are weakened in that kind of way, a terrorist attack that captures the headlines can be a way of demonstrating continuing viability. And to be able to do anything while the president is in country would be a propaganda boon for the organization. It's unlikely that they could conduct any kind of attack that would harm the president himself, and they have traditionally struck soft targets in the region. So any kind of operation, whether it be a soft target in Kenya or even in Somalia, it would be something that the group could do to try and recapture the headlines and demonstrate that it's been damaged, but it is still a viable organization and a threat.
As you know, Nigerian President Buhari just visited President Obama, and one of the things they talked about was the terrorist group or militant group Boko Haram operating in northern Nigeria. And we see that Mr. Buhari is not really satisfied with a U.S. law that sort of restricts aid to the country if there's suspicion of corruption. What does that say about the U.S. relationship between Kenya and Nigeria?
Corruption has been a big consideration in East Africa as well as in Nigeria. And there's also in Nigeria been human rights concerns with some of their counterterrorism operations. So there's balancing priorities. In order to really have effective counterterrorism and effective governance, issues like corruption do have to be addressed. There are systemic problems that weaken a government's capability. So these remain critical issues, even if they don't capture the headlines the same way that counterterrorism can, especially the brutality of groups like Boko Haram. But they really are interwoven with one another, and you can't effectively do one when the other one remains a problem.
Now, President Obama also is visiting Ethiopia, which has played a major role in Somalia in fighting al-Shabaab at times. What kind of relationship does the U.S. have with Ethiopia regarding anti-terrorism activities?
The United States has had a long-standing, very strong counterterrorism relationship with Ethiopia. Ethiopia has seen al-Shabaab as a threat since its earliest days, and has been very aggressive at addressing that threat. Thus far, Ethiopia has been fairly capable of preventing attacks within its borders. Whereas Kenya and Uganda have suffered from al-Shabaab directly. So the U.S. And Ethiopia will continue to be very strong partners against al-Shabaab, and Ethiopia sees this very much as its own problem, and so will seek any kind of assistance that it can get from the United States in countering this organization.
Many groups have called upon President Obama to bring up human rights, both in Kenya and Ethiopia. For example, in Kenya, there have been complaints that Kenya has cracked down on the media, and certainly charges like that have been ongoing in Ethiopia for a long time. Do you think those issues might come up?
It's possible that those issues will come up, and they have sometimes been in tension with these government's counterterrorism efforts. Their counterterrorism efforts have been seen as violating human rights and sometimes press rights as well. So it is quite possible that this will be part of the discussion that the president has with these governments, how to balance these concerns. Because as we've seen other places, overly heavy-handed counterterrorism operations can actually exacerbate the terrorism problem. So it is a balance that governments have to strike, you know, to be effective in terms of their counterterrorism without going so far as to alienate more people and to provide more support for terrorist organizations through overly heavy-handed operations.
Tricia Bacon is an associate professor at American University who focuses on terror threats. She spoke to VOA's Jody Kepua. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari says U.S. restrictions on the sale of strategic weapons to Nigeria is aiding and abetting the Islamist extremist of Boko Haram. Earlier this week, Mr. Buhari failed to persuade the United States to suspend the so-called Leahy Law supported by the U.S. Congress. It would halt weapons sales to governments accused of gross human rights violations. Amnesty International has charged the Nigerian military with the deaths of 8,000 detainees. Mr. Buhari returned yesterday from a trip to Washington, where he discussed his challenges in Nigeria with President Barack Obama and members of Congress. The war against Boko Haram was high on Mr. Buhari's agenda, but a request for arms was not granted. Mr. Buhari says the U.S. law aids the Boko Haram terrorist group in the implementation of its extreme ideology and hate, and in the indiscriminate killings and maimings of civilians. His government has complained of a lack of sufficient weapons to put an end to a six-year reign of terror in three northwest states of Nigeria and in neighboring Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. Mr. Buhari told One U.S. audience his military is largely impotent to put down the insurgency. In other news, the death toll has risen to 40 in Gombe, where suicide bombers blew up two bus stations on Wednesday. Across the border in Cameroon, suicide bombers took the lives of 20 civilians in the central market and neighborhood of Marua. The U.S. State Department has released a statement today condemning the horrific and indiscriminate Boko Haram attacks on both cities. Nigeria's new president, Muhammadu Buhari, is expected in Cameroon July 29th to discuss how to tackle the Boko Haram insurgency and piracy in the Gulf of Guinea with his Cameroonian counterpart, Paul Biya. The two neighbors have a long history of security challenges. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports on what is expected from the visit.
Businessman Eric Odos from Nigeria's Imo State has been in Cameroon for 25 years. The 50-year-old advisor to the Union of Nigerians Living in Cameroon says what they want is peace.
His Excellency President Buhari, the one that we're expecting is to join her with the president of this country, His Excellency Paul Biya, with the foreign president to fight against Boko Haram. When you look around, the economy of the country is so down. Because of insecurity, it affects everybody, be the national, be the foreigners.
There are over 3 million Nigerians living in Cameroon. They have been joined by 80,000 refugees fleeing the Boko Haram insurgency. Ntuda Ebode, a geopolitical scientist, says among those seeking refuge are Boko Haram suspects. He says Mr. Biya and Mr. Buhari should agree on hot pursuit.
La coalition permet au Nigeria de traiter à l'intérieur du Nigeria.
He says Nigeria should negotiate a coalition to pursue suspects right into its neighbor's territories because Boko Haram fighters seek refuge in foreign lands when they are wanted in Nigeria. Ntuda adds that Boko Haram has funding from some countries, has allies in other countries, and has been seizing war weapons from regular armies. He says since its creation, Boko Haram has had enough time to gather enough financial, human material, and relational capital. Cameroon shares a 2,100-kilometer border with Nigeria, spanning across mountains and deserts in the north, dense forest in the south, and 21 border points in the ocean. Bloody conflicts made the International Court of Justice order the demarcation of the Cameroon-Nigeria border, and the oil-rich Bakassi Peninsula was handed to Cameroon. Professor Tazuacha Asonganyi says Mr. Biya and Mr. Buhari are likely to discuss dissenting voices from disgruntled Nigerians who want Bakassi back.
There is a group pushing for Nigeria to take back Bakassi or at least reopen the negotiations. But since he was president and since his troops were in Bakassi, a lot of water has gone under the bridge. His presidency is a continuity of the presidencies that have been since he left power as a military head of state.
The two presidents are also to discuss piracy in the Gulf of Guinea. the Cameroon-based International Center Against Piracy in the Gulf of Guinea reports that Cameroon and Nigeria lose between 40,000 and 100,000 barrels per day due to theft, and business and investments have been slowed in the Gulf because of regular armed conflicts. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Nigeria has hit a major milestone. It's been a year since anyone in the country has had polio, the crippling disease that mainly affects children, although a lot of work still needs to be done. VOA's Carol Pearson reports that this achievement for Nigeria impacts all of Africa and the rest of the world.
Nigeria is the latest country to rid itself of the scourge of polio. Ellen Ogden works with USAID's polio eradication program.
They were the largest country in Africa that had ongoing cases.
Ogden says national pride, along with pressure from the international community and Nigerian health leaders, prompted the government to commit to eradicating polio. Getting all Nigerian children immunized was a huge challenge. It took the government, thousands of volunteers, and help from the World Health Organization, UNICEF, Rotary International, and others to get it done. They tracked nomadic tribes, immunized children in areas of conflict during lulls in fighting, worked with leaders who resisted immunization on political or religious grounds and for other reasons. Oyewale Tomori heads the Nigerian Academy of Science and chairs the country's Committee on Polio Eradication. He says education was the key in persuading people to let their children get immunized.
The people, once they realize what needs to be done, they actually go out and get it done.
But now, even more vigilance is needed, according to Carol Pandek with Rotary International, who spoke via Skype.
They need to continue to do high-quality immunization campaigns for the next several years. Also, have a very strong surveillance system.
That's because the virus can hide in people who don't get sick, but pass it on to others who do. Children need 6 doses of the oral vaccine to be protected from polio for life. While this achievement is a milestone for Nigeria, it's a fragile accomplishment. Nigeria has to stay polio-free for 3 years. If it does, Ellen Ogden says the virus will no longer exist in Africa.
We're trying to wipe it off the face of the earth and make sure that no one is able to come in contact with it and get paralyzed again.
Now the focus shifts to Afghanistan and Pakistan, the only two countries in the world that have active cases of polio. If these countries can immunize all of their children, the world will finally be polio-free. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
You are listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Burundi's President Pierre Nkurunziza has won a third term in office. U.S. President Barack Obama arrives in Kenya this evening for the start of a landmark two-day visit to discuss trade and security. And Nigeria's new President Muhammadu Buhari visits Cameroon July 29th to discuss the Boko Haram insurgency with his Cameroonian counterpart, Paul Biya. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. More than 40 migrants drowned when their inflatable rubber dinghy began to sink off the coast of Libya Wednesday. A German naval vessel rescued another 80 migrants from the raft after being alerted by a passing cargo ship. A spokesman for the humanitarian agency Save the Children says survivors told them they were from Senegal, Mali, and Benin. Seven of the dead were children between the ages of 7 and 16. Save the Children says the German ship also brought to shore 283 others rescued migrants. Two other boats in the European Union's rescue mission delivered another 669 immigrants to Sicily and southern Italy during the day. Italy is a main European entry point for African and Syrian refugees. More than 85,000 have landed on Italy's shores in the last 7 months. The World Health Organization reports the agency will begin testing a promising malaria vaccine in October to see if it should be used in African countries affected by this parasitic disease. WHO says it will issue its recommendations in November. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization calls the development of this candidate vaccine a major milestone. It notes this is the first time ever that a malaria vaccine has been reviewed by a regulatory authority. On Friday, the European Medicines Agency issued a positive assessment of the GlaxoSmithKline vaccine called Mosquirix, essentially giving the WHO the green light to review the product for its use in Africa. WHO spokesman Gregory Hartl says this is a big step forward, and the health agency will look at the new vaccine from the point of view of public health.
What we will need to do is look at issues such as the feasibility of using this vaccine in field situations in developing countries. We need to look at its affordability and its cost effectiveness. We will also need to look at the public health value of the vaccine in relation to other malaria control measures.
Scientists have been searching for an effective vaccine against malaria for decades. Mosquirix is the first one, which has gone through a phase 3 trial. Malaria infects 200 million people worldwide every year and kills nearly 600,000, most of them children under the age of 5 in Africa. If the vaccine is proven to work, health officials believe it could potentially save millions of lives. Clinical trial results show the vaccine offers only partial protection, preventing 1 in 3 cases of malaria. Children between the ages of 5 and 17 months who receive 3 doses of the vaccine 1 month apart with a booster shot several months later were the best protected. The trial also found the vaccine to be less effective among infants between 6 and 12 weeks of age. WHO's Hartl cautions against pinning too much hope on the vaccine. Despite its promise, he says the vaccine must not take precedence over tried and true malaria control measures.
We just want to stress that any financing for this vaccine has to not draw away resources from other interventions such as scaling up bed nets and rapid diagnostic tests for malaria. The malaria vaccine needs to be viewed and will be reviewed in the context of an overall panoply of public health tools for the combating of malaria.
If the WHO's assessment of the vaccine is positive, Hartl says applications for its use will have to go forward to national regulatory authorities for approval. He says this process is likely to be completed at the earliest in 2017. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
The sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. U.S. President Barack Obama arrives in Kenya this evening for the start of a landmark two-day visit to discuss trade and security. And Nigeria's new president, Muhammadu Buhari, visits Cameroon July 29th to discuss Boko Haram insurgency with his Cameroonian counterpart, Paul Biya. Coming up, music from Burundi, and in our feature segment, the South Sudanese diaspora in the Washington, D.C. area. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Friday, Yehias.
Sunny, I understand you're kicking off in Russia.
Yehias, the preliminary draw for the 2018 World Cup football tournament will be held Saturday in St. Petersburg, Russia. Russian President Vladimir Putin and FIFA President Sepp Blatter will be center stage in St. Petersburg for the festivities, which will be watched by a worldwide television audience. Our football guru, David Legg, breaks down the draw for us in terms of the African teams.
There will be two draws as far as Africa is concerned, first round and the second round. The third round draw will take place at a later stage. Of immediate significance is the fact that Zimbabwe will be missing. Zimbabweans did not pay a severance package due to a Brazilian coach. And because of that, FIFA have expelled Zimbabwe from the draw. And for somebody like myself, who basically learned his football journalism in Zimbabwe, working for the Herald in Harare, and also for the Zimbabwe Broadcasting Corporation, I'm truly sad because I was privileged to be with the Zimbabwe team when they made their World Cup debut way back in 1981 in the Atlantic city of Douala in Cameroon. It was a match that featured, among others in the Zimbabwe team, Bruce Cobbler, who went on to become a star goalkeeper for Liverpool. And Zimbabwe lost that match, unfortunately, by 2-0. They won the return match 1-0, but were eliminated. So sad, Sunny, indeed, that Zimbabwe will not be part of this draw. And they're the only African country who will not be involved. The other 53 will be there. Now, of those 53, the lower-ranked 26, that's in the July FIFA rankings, they will go into the first round draw. There will be 13 pairings, matches played at home and away in October. And let's look at those two pots. Pot 1, which has the 13 higher-ranked teams, consists of the following countries: Niger, Ethiopia, Malawi, Sierra Leone, Namibia, Kenya, Botswana, Madagascar, Mauritania, Burundi, Lesotho, Guinea-Bissau, and Swaziland. And Pot 2, which will contain the 13 lower-ranked teams, in other words, the 13 weakest football nations in Africa, that pot will consist of Tanzania, Gambia, Liberia, Central African Republic, Chad, Mauritius, Seychelles, Comores, Sao Tome e Principe, South Sudan, competing for the first time, so well done to them, Eritrea, Somalia, and Djibouti. So you'll have 13 pairings, Sunny, in October, home and away. And those 13 overall winners will qualify for the second round, and that's when the big boys come into play. These matches will also be on a home and away basis, and they'll be played this November. Seeded teams, that's the top 20 ranked teams in Africa at the moment, are as follows: Ivory Coast, Algeria, Ghana, Tunisia, Senegal, Cameroon, Congo-Brazzaville, Cape Verde, Egypt, Nigeria, Guinea, Democratic Republic of Congo, Mali, Equatorial Guinea, Gabon, South Africa, Zambia, Burkina Faso, Uganda, and Rwanda. So they will be kept apart from the following seven countries who are unseeded, namely Togo, Morocco, Sudan, Angola, Mozambique, Benin, and Libya. And on top of those seven countries, Sunny, you will also have those 13 first-round winners. So you'll have 20 seeded teams and 20 unseeded teams. Now, there always are those teams that the big boys want to avoid. And who are they on this occasion? Well, if you look at the unseeded teams, the one that jumps out to me are the Atlas Lions of Morocco. They have qualified for the World Cup four times, so not the power that they used to be. But my feeling, Sonny, is that in Abidjan, in Algiers, in Abuja, in Lagos, in Port Harcourt, or wherever, the supporters of Nigeria and Ivory Coast and Algeria and the other giants, they will not want to face Morocco. That would be a really tough tie, home and away in November. And that would mean that whoever Morocco play, the losers of that tie are out of the World Cup. They can forget about any dreams of going to Russia in 2018. Who are the other countries you might like to avoid? Well, Togo, for me, are a case in point. Togo can be extremely good and extremely bad. We saw that in the last Cup of Nations. And I'm very sorry, Sonny, that I have to mention this for a certain VOA gentleman. His first name happens to be Douglas. I have to remind Douglas that Togo beat Uganda at home and away and basically spoiled the hopes of the Uganda Cranes of getting to the Cup of Nations for the first time since 1978. Yes, Douglas, it's been that long ago. Now, the thing about the Togolese, Sonny, they have a certain moody, but when on form, a very talented striker in Emmanuel Adebayor. You know, half the time he's either retired or he's not interested in playing, but when he does play, he can be a real threat. And I would say Togo are pretty close to the top of other coaches' lists of teams to avoid. So to me, Morocco definitely first, and probably Togo, Angola possibly as well. So on Saturday evening, Sonny, in St. Petersburg, we will know exactly where we stand. And the winners of those 20 second-round ties, which are scheduled for November, they will be split into five groups of four, and those matches will be played on dates to be announced, but certainly not before next year. And the winners of those five groups, Sonny, they are the countries that will represent Africa at the 2018 World Cup in Russia.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Voice of America!
Avoid direct skin and body contact with anyone suffering from Ebola. My name is Cristiano Ronaldo. Together, we can beat Ebola.
The Ebola crisis brought everything to a grinding halt in Sierra Leone last year when it was at its peak. This included the sports industry. Public gatherings were banned, and that meant teams couldn't practice properly. Many athletes were also denied visas to compete abroad. Nina DeVries has more from Freetown, Sierra Leone.
Marathon runner Idrissa Kargbo is worried about his future career, partly because of the Ebola crisis. He holds the national record in Sierra Leone at 2 hours 32 minutes and has run in London and New York City marathons over the past 2 years. Now he has a chance to go to Cape Town, South Africa to compete in a marathon in September. But he's concerned he will be denied a visa.
I am worried a little bit because I don't know what is going to come over because of I am in affected country.
Other athletes have been denied visas due to the Ebola situation, says Mohamed Vangahan, technical director of the Sierra Leone volleyball team. His team lost its chance to compete in the Youth Olympic Games last year in China.
We are hoping to go and represent Africa in that championship. Unfortunately, we are denied visas by the Chinese embassy, and we could not take part in that competition. Of course, it was not good for our players. Imagine, they had trained for over 2 months for that competition.
Whoa.
But the players are not letting that get them down too much. Florence Amara is the team captain.
We have the spirits, we have the ambition, we have the determination.
That attitude of determination may pay off. The Sierra Leone boxing team was recently granted a visa to compete next month in the United States. That gives athletes like Carbo and Amara hope, especially since Ebola cases in the country have decreased generally, except for a few small areas.
Hey, come on, team. Come on, go.
Now the big challenge is getting back up to speed on their own game. Until recently, public gatherings of more than 10 people were banned to prevent the spread of Ebola. That means teams had to make do with fewer players, says Amara.
It affects me as a captain because I'll not be able to see the kind of competitiveness I like to see in training. I'll not see all the techniques will not be available on the players because some players have been left out. Sometimes the pressure is on me.
Kargbo is still concerned about catching the virus, so he runs alone for now.
I miss a social aspect because I used to train with my friends.
He also hopes more financial assistance will be offered to athletes like him who mainly rely on international support. And like Amara, he's not giving up and hopes to compete at the Olympic Games in Rio in 2016. Nina DeVries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. I received a nice Facebook message from Ernest Izugwu, a student in Asaba, Nigeria. Ernest writes, "I love the Sunny Side of Sports so much." Well, Ernest, I love receiving messages like that so much. The humble apostle of the Sunny Side of Sports, Magnus Chisholm Onwudiwe, checks in again from Owerri, Imo State, Nigeria. Magnus responds to what David Legg said on Thursday's show about Sunday Olise, Nigeria's new football coach. David said, and I quote, "He strikes me as a man with a very sharp football brain, but I wonder if he has that thick rhinoceros skin that Keshi seemed to have, and one feels at times you need just to survive in that cauldron of Nigerian football." The humble apostle in Owerri says, thick rhinoceros skin indeed, because you don't only need to have a sharp brain, but you have to develop that thick skin to absorb all manner of verbal banters from mostly impatient Nigerian fans. Thanks for checking in again, humble apostle. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to you, Hayes. Woo-hee.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, the South Sudanese diaspora in the Washington, D.C. area. And next, a restaurant in Accra, now the go-to place for great food, parties, and live music. But first, our own music. Here is Kidum of Burundi with Ambambuzi.
Om Dafer, Gango Yusufu Matoma, Yahaya Hussein, Papa Grace, Charles Ogada, Digital Entertainment Promotion. Ah, c'est ça. Mama Kibido, Maurice Oyano. Todie, todie.
Yesu pamo ansama sejoro. Yesu pamo wisera. Kandi wajiwa mamako. Te wa kensi na mogo samara Bitumwa kensi niki ya babu Jama rongo mesi Ineka vizosa ya pika mbwa
Nasigara widoga wichuza Kwesi yominya kanura mushinga naye Kanura mufasoni Yisi siwe nyigise Abanu bundi batifina Abambuzi tabara bafise Abutera kesu titeguye
Abukurinda bambuzi
Papa grasa
Wame maso kukuzika mitina chawe
Kari ukinu
Mera makabano jambo mokono razasi
Winde
Wirinde, wirinda bambuzi
Bambuzi, bambuzi
Wirinde, wirinda basura, basura, basura
Mutko abiri yakuya
Nuse wigeru ya yata
Mutko awe ni mana
Nuse wigeru twanjwa twako
Umviri sanchuti anje umugishu tangwa ni mana Babambuzi basa kwisi na kari baruse nyanzu kibuza Ulivyo rero roja mumo kondo razusi Ine kabizo sayapwe nikute kukia kunye Kanura musinga na ye, kanura mufasoni Yisi si minyigisi, ana nubo ni bakifina Babambuzi tavara wafise, abutera kesu titekuye
Wakati
aletse kawagasema
Wame maso kukuzika mitunda chawe
Kandi kabiri karatiko
Mera makabano jambo mokono razasi
Mera hezo mngibuza
Wirinde, wirinda mambuzi
Aho
Wirinde, wirinda basura, basura, basura
Imitwe, tirarira
Burundi's Kidum with Abambuzi. Not all South Sudanese in the Washington, D.C. diaspora agree. Tensions over diaspora leadership in the metropolitan this D.C. area was on display last weekend when two groups celebrated independence 10 miles apart. Many South Sudanese here say they should have united to honor those who lost their lives fighting for independence. South Sudan in Focus reporter Ayan Bior has more.
One people, one tribe, one nation, but two separate Independence Day gatherings for South Sudanese here in the D.C. metropolitan area. The celebrations were just 20 minutes apart. Several people at both gatherings wondered aloud why there had to be two celebrations instead of one. South Sudanese Ambassador to the U.S. Gareng Dingakwang, who attended both, pinpoints when the division began.
The division occurred during the last elections, where some community members were excluded from the new office. That one created divisions.
Angelo McCare was one of the members of the community excluded from office. He was told that he did not live within the confines where the elected body operates, although he was allowed to be a member of the TSSC, or the South Sudanese community, he could not act in an official capacity. McCare, who organized the other Independence Day celebration, was not available for comment. Dut Akot, who attended both celebrations on Saturday, questions Makare's motives for hosting a separate event in the same city.
Why he don't do it in Richmond, Virginia? Why he bring it close to you? It become to believe that it was not for him, it was for you, you ambassador. It couldn't have been for you. You might have funded him and say, do this in my name, and I'm gonna come and join you and eat your food, and I'm gonna leave the food and the drink for the community that has put us in together, and you say, so should it be for you.
Ambassador Akwang says the embassy had hoped to help the two groups settle their differences.
The head of that committee, who is the deputy ambassador, tried to mediate between the two communities, and he talked to the two leaders of the two communities to try to harmonize the celebration, and that they should come under one umbrella and organize the celebration.
Ambassador Akwang denies accusations that the embassy was enabling the division by providing official funds to both parties.
We did not provide funds, and our records are there, are clear, banks are there. We do not provide, and because we didn't have enough funds for our celebration. So we do not provide funds.
Abraham Alak attended the celebration hosted by the TSSC. He says he strongly believes the diaspora should be united.
The problem don't divide the people. Everybody, people had the differences. Like you can see now, like there's some people will suit, some other people will not suit, because people are different. So, but we can accept our differences and work together.
For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
Having a prime location is a major key to success for any business owner. Gina Grant Dadizi, owner of Kum Samba La Bamba Beach restaurant in Accra, Ghana, could not have found a better place. This eatery is now the go-to place for great food, parties, live music, and of course, beautiful scenery. Paul Ndiho reports from Accra.
Ghana has a rich culture, one that it has managed to hold on for centuries. This culture is reflected in Ghanaian cuisine. It features traditional dishes from each ethnic group, tribe and clan. Most Ghanaian dishes are comprised of a starchy portion and a sauce of fish, goat meat or beef stew. This trendy event is evident at the Ultimate Bar and Restaurant.
We operate every day, Monday to Sunday. Our main dishes are local, continental, and Chinese. With the local, we have our local dishes known as fufu, banku, everything local that Ghanaians eat.
Founded nearly 7 years ago by Joseph Connie Mensah, this restaurant is now generating a buzz for its great food and attracting hundreds of people every day and weekend for live music. Now, Mensah is expanding his brand. He recently acquired a custom mobile kitchen that caters for outside catering, parties, and wedding receptions.
We have grilled chicken, and fried rice, jollof, ultimate special rice. But among all, the chicken sauce or beef sauce move faster.
His ambition to own a restaurant started when he was a young man. He mastered his craft in London and the US, where he worked in different kitchens before he moved back to his native country to launch the Ultimate Bar and Restaurant.
I started small, but as time moved on, I leased the land, the place that I was doing. My time got closer, so I moved into my own house.
Customers here are spoiled for choice, sampling everything from banku and everything local Ghanaians eat. Assistant Chef Benjamin likes preparing fried rice and pizza.
If I have my leisure time, I move around to work with small people to train them for them to also to become like me, because it's through him before I also become like this.
Monica Anawi has been working here since the restaurant opened. Her specialty is making traditional foods like okra stew. She says that she enjoys bringing a smile to people's faces.
People kind of say, oh, your food is nice, it's very tasty. Then when they say that about you, you feel good, you feel proud. The next time, you make sure you do the way you did it first, they didn't complain about it.
The Ultimate, a bar and restaurant, employs more than 30 full-time workers and has positioned itself as the best place to work for in the area. Experts say the eatery has the potential to grow beyond Accra and spread to other cities, hungry for a real taste of Ghanaian cuisine.
That was Paul Ndiho reporting from Accra. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiye Swuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Pete Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
In another sign of the United States' determination to help the nations of Africa combat terrorism, millions of dollars in rewards are being offered for information on several top leaders of the Al-Qaeda-linked Somalia-based terrorist organization Harakat Shabab al-Mujahideen, or Al-Shabaab. The group, listed as a foreign terrorist organization since 2008, is battling that nation's government for control of Somalia, and has also carried out a string of attacks in Kenya, most recently at a college in the town of Garissa. It is responsible for the deaths of thousands of Somali civilians, peace activists, international aid workers, journalists, and civilians, as well as African Union peacekeepers who are helping to restore stability and prosperity to the region. Tens of thousands of people have been forced to flee their homes amid the fighting. Under the terrorist designation, the United States imposed financial and other restrictions on the group, blocking property and prohibiting U.S. persons from engaging in transactions with its members. Now the U.S. is offering rewards for information leading to the location of six of its leaders. Rewards of up to $5 million each are offered for information on the location of Ibrahim Haji Jama, also known as Abu Zalma, Fuad Muhammad Khalaf, a dual Somali and Swedish national, also known as Fuad Shungala, Bashir Mohammed Mahmoud, an al-Shabaab military commander believed to have been born between 1979 and 1982, and Mukhtar Robo, a 43-year-old who has served as an al-Shabaab spokesman and who carries an Eritrean passport. Rewards of up to $3 million each are offered for information on the location of two additional al-Shabaab leaders, Abdullahi Yare and the group's intelligence chief, Zakaria Ismail Ahmed Hersi, also known as Zaki Madobi. The United States guarantees all credible reports will be investigated, and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on any of these men, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.